I guess sometimes it's important to come to terms with some of these things too. But what I'm, just to review, since some of you are new, I don't know all of your names. I know Barb and Marge and Julie.
And I'm Jan, I came the first time.
And you're Jan.
Renee.
And you, pardon?
Renee.
Renee.
And Pam.
Pam.
Jan.
Okay.
Everyone's waiting at the bus.
They're waiting at the bus?
Yeah, they're going to wave goodbye.
Yes.
Well, John, are you leaving on this bus too or not?
Oh, I'm going on the slow boat.
That was so
good. Oh, I just feel kind of bad. You know, when you get to know these people, you just feel like you wish you could know them longer or more.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just wanted to warn folks that this is some of these things I'm going to read are pretty graphic and stomach-turning. But to review, for those of you who have not been here before, I talked early on about the history, just a little bit. I gave a thumbnail sketch of canonical history and what the great books really are and how we got them, how they became selected as the great books. But more important, I tried to give you some criteria as to how you could decide what makes great literature and the difference between a good book and a great book. And the reason I do that is because my English majors at Augustana College, they can know that by the time they graduate, they know critical school and period and genre. And, oh, I had some seniors in a senior seminar, and I said, okay, well, tell me what makes a great book. And, oh, they couldn't tell me. They couldn't tell me, and I waited. So I won't tell you that whole story. But anyway, I was really concerned. So we have these criteria, and some of you know them already, and some of them you don't. But I hope they're worth repeating. The first one is something that fires your soul. It's the kind of thing that you read it, and it will change you. Mm-hmm. It's like listening to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, or like going to, at least for me, to see a French Impressionist painting, or hiking up to Holden Village and know that you made it, even if you lost a few toenails. But there's just that life-affirming moment, and it's not always pretty, it's not always great, as you'll see today, in terms of you know, just going, oh, I'm just so happy now that I read this. It can change you in ways that make you deeply concerned or think deeply about things too. So anyway, there's that change. But the first is something that fires your soul. It will change you. The second is a character who comes alive. In Sophie's Choice, Sophie comes alive. Here, these guys all come alive. The third thing is something beautiful in terms of how the language is used. The contrast, the diction, the irony. And you'll see here today too that the language here is not pretty, but at least in my opinion, it's just beautifully written. So that's one of the criteria. And then finally, two more. One, something of ethical significance. I mean, you can't have a major drama in fiction about, you know, what kind of socks I'm going to wear up to the lake to Holden Village. But it's got to have something of deep ethical significance. And then finally, the final criteria is as simple as this: it's something you want to return to. You know, this is a book, I've read it a number of times, and every time I read it, I find something new in it. So that's the larger framework that we have when we're talking about can great books be bad for you? So today, I want to talk about truth in fiction and fiction in truth. The controversy arose, I'm sure you've all heard of the Oprah controversy with James Frey. He passed himself off as writing something that was a biography, that was real, that really happened. And as that book was going to press, the editor started to have suspicions. The editor questioned him. He says, no, it's literally true, every last word. Then pretty soon his parole officer, there were stats and data. He wasn't in prison for days. He was just there for hours, and he wasn't these things just didn't happen. As Dennis would confirm, that he didn't get his teeth knocked out the way he said he did, and so on and so on. So there was this big uproar about him betraying the truth. And it's one thing to talk about fiction, but it's another thing to pretend that you're telling a story. In this book, O'Brien goes out of his way to tell us that there's a very big difference between real truth and storytelling truth. And I've heard him speak. He came to Augustana College, and he argued that storytelling truth is a lot of times more real than real truth. That's the argument that he made. That storytelling truth is more real than real truth. So those are fighting words for some of my students, particularly the first years, who felt, well, either you tell the truth or you don't, or it's arbitrary, it's right or it's wrong. And what I tried to teach them is that it's not always that simple. So anyway, I'm going to let you decide for yourselves, but I'll read you some examples of this this morning, and then maybe we can talk about how you feel about this. I think you'll get the point in the things they carried.
So, but how did you feel about the James Fry thing? Because I just felt like it was such a tempest in a teapot. Was it because he had claimed so strongly that it was? Because he didn't come...
Julie, I think... Yeah, you can.
Because I agree with this, that storytelling truth, you know, is more real. You
yeah.
know, and if what he wrote was a good and powerful book, I didn't...
Right, right. I think the big rub is this, and again, you know, you'll have to decide for yourself whether you think this is right or wrong. But in his instance, he was selling this as a biography, as a fact. When he was confronted about, you know, have you taken any liberty with the facts, he insisted over and over that he had not. When Oprah was asked him, he said, no, this is true. There's some pretty compelling evidence that he did that along with his publisher because they knew they could sell copies. I mean, you know, Oprah's a gold mine.
That it would sell more as an autobiography than it would as a fictionalized story.
In that instance, yes.
Well, okay. That was the reason.
But see, the other issue has to do, I mean, it kind of dovetailed with some other things that were happening in the press at the time. There was, there have been reporters, I could remember the name, but oh, about 7 years ago there was a reporter for the New York Times.
The plagiarism. And he was making stuff up.
Somebody who...
I can't remember his name either.
But anyway, it was an individual who was talking about life in the black ghetto. It's that same kind of realistic, what do those people live like, how are they thinking, and what happens, the life of a prostitute. And this was all fabricated. None of this happened.
Well,
I think it was a heroin addict, a prostitute.
Pardon? A woman reporter, too, who did a story about a child or something.
In Washington, D.C.
And that was totally...
So we're in this era right now where people are becoming more and more concerned about that. The other issue arose from whether or not...
The 12 steps worked.
Okay. All right, that's one. So you can all think of really great examples of this. The other issue comes down right down to whether or not we've been lied about, you know, in terms of what really happened in the war, how that's happened.
Oh, yeah.
So, in fact, I have a newspaper clipping, unless I left it upstairs. I thought I had it here with me. Oh, I bet I did leave it up there. Oh, no, here it is. This is about the Vietnam War. And the reason I cut it out was because it pertained to this book. But it also has to do with truth. Now, this is not fiction, but this was in the New York Times, and it had to do with the reporting of the war in Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin issue, and this was published on October 31, 2005. All right? And it says... the National Security Agency has kept secret since 2001 a finding by any agency historian that during the Tonkin Gulf episode, that helped precipitate the Vietnam War, NASA officers deliberately distorted critical intelligence to cover their mistakes. Mm-hmm. All right, so this hit the Times not so long ago. But anyway, I could pass this around. You can read it if you want. But it says, rather than come clean about the mistake that they made, they helped launch the United States into a bloody war that would last for 10 years. And so it goes on to explain 58,000 Americans and more than 1 million Vietnamese died. So you can imagine why that would be hot news. And what's scary about it, if you read the second paragraph here, even at that time, that much later, they still tried to suppress this because they were afraid it would kick off more controversy about the war that we are now in. But anyway, I can pass this. I want to take a look at this while I'm talking. You can. But so the point is that there are a variety of different ways of telling the truth. In some issues, in the issue of James Fry and in the plagiarism issues, those were just outright lies that people did to exploit the news or to make a profit or to look like you were really you really had to scoop on this heroin addict, you know, in the Bronx. But Tim O'Brien does something very, very different. He tells us in the things they carried, he tinkers from the get-go. He starts tinkering around with the truth. And first of all, he starts the story out on in the things they carried by seemingly giving us details, almost cataloging things. And so we can assume that this has got to be true because he's given a list of the things they carried. But as I'll read this first page or so, it's kind of hard to teach you if you haven't read things and you don't have the books. So I'll do some reading today. But anyway, you'll see that there are details, there's kind of, the style is kind of clipped, it's kind of a guy style, there's not any fluffy gal talk about this at all. Right. But it's just straight to the point. First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross carried letters from a girl named Martha, a junior at Mount Sebastian College in New Jersey. They were not love letters, but Lieutenant Cross was hoping. So he kept them, folded in plastic at the bottom of his rucksack. In the late afternoon, after a day's march, he would dig his foxhole, wash his hands under a canteen, unwrap the letters, hold them with the tips of his fingers, and spend the last hour of the night pretending. Now, this never really did happen. There wasn't a guy, if you ask Tim O'Brien, there wasn't a guy named Jimmy Cross. But there was a guy like that. And maybe he didn't have a girlfriend named Martha, and maybe he didn't read these letters. But nevertheless, if you're like me, when you read this, you can see how precarious their existence is. Mm-hmm. You know, how lonely he must be. How very human these guys are. And I'll read on. So imagine digging into a foxhole, taking out a letter, and you know it's not really a love letter, but you're hoping, and you're going to bed down in this foxhole at night, and you're going to bed with this letter. He would imagine romantic camping trips to the White Mountains in New Hampshire. He would sometimes taste the envelope flaps, knowing her tongue had been there. More than anything, he wanted Martha to love him as he loved her. But the letters were mostly chatty, elusive on the matters of love. She was a virgin, he was almost sure. She was an English major at Mount Sebastian, and she wrote beautifully about the professors and roommates and midterm exams, about her respect for Chaucer and her great affection for Virginia Woolf. She often quoted lines of poetry. She never mentioned the war, except to say, Jimmy, take care of yourself. The letters weighed 10 ounces. They were signed Love, Martha, but Lieutenant Cross understood that love was only a way of signing it, and so on and so on and so on. So what does this tell you? Imagine this guy. What are we learning from this? John, what are we learning from this?
That he kind of clings to these letters, kind of, because he's in such a different situation and he doesn't want to kind of escape.
Okay, you might be an English major. Is it really, is, what about this English major here? If you had to describe Martha in one word, what would you use?
One word? She sounds studious.
Pardon?
I don't know. She sounds studious. She's talking about all the different...
Okay, she's an English major. I read this again. She wrote beautifully about her professors and roommates and midterm exams, about her respect for Chaucer and a great affection for Virginia Woolf. She also quoted poetry, and she never mentioned the war. And she said, Jimmy, take good care of yourself.
She's not in the real world.
She's not in the real world. I would think maybe shallow. You know, and this guy is hanging on by a fingernail for what may happen next in his life. And she's saying, I love Chaucer, I love Virginia Woolf, I'm an English major.
But maybe that's what he needs. He needs to have a different, an area away from the war, because he's in the war. And maybe he needs this.
She talks about herself.
Yeah,
and
it's all
about her.
She knows too.
Yeah,
she knows.
Yeah,
she loves Virginia.
Have you ever written letters to strangers overseas in a war situation? It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, tell us.
You can't put yourself in their position. You have no concept
of
what. But you know that the human touch is important.
Yeah.
You know that that they need to hear. Yeah. What do you write about? I mean, is it shallow, or is it just that she's trying to stay in touch and doesn't know what else to write about?
She doesn't know what else to say.
Mm-hmm. But they obviously have a lot of impact on him. They have a lot of meaning to him, and they're offering, if he's doing that, it's like it's offering him comfort, like a blanket offers a child comfort.
Okay.
If he's rubbing it and touching it at night to go to sleep.
But he wants more.
Is this really, is this?
It's his hope.
Let me, okay, he hopes. He has hopes. Is this really about Martha at all?
No, I don't think
it's about him.
It's about him. So, in terms of the truth, what are we starting to learn? We're not up to him talking about the truth yet, but the truth is that she loves Chaucer, and she cares about him. She says, take good care of yourself. What's the real truth that's going on here?
I think she's fearful to connect on a more basis.
Oh, I think you got that exactly right. But what about, what's truth to Jimmy Cross?
That he might not make it out of there.
That he might not make it out of there. You got it. That's the reality. And then Tim O'Brien is telling us just by these stark details, you know, what he's seeing, what he thinks, and so on. He talks about the things they carried. Pretty soon, he'll give us a whole list. The things they carried were largely determined by necessity. Among the necessities, or near necessities, were P-38 can openers, pocket knives, heat tabs, wrist watches, dog tags, mosquito repellent, chewing gum, candy, cigarettes, salt tablets, packets of Kool-Aid, lighters, matches, sewing kits. And this goes on and on and on. And so a lot of this is cataloged. Ted Lavender, who was scared, carried 34 rounds when he was shot and killed outside. He carried a lot of tranquilizer. This guy was on drugs big time. This goes on. They were tough. So after this whole big catalog list, and you hear that Ted Lavender was shot, and he carried lots of tranquilizers, lots of drugs. But that's the only thing you hear about them for now. And then you hear this. They were tough. They carried all the emotional baggage of men who might die. So now we're taking a journey away from the physical to the metaphorical. Grief, terror, love, longing. These were intangibles, but the intangibles had their own mass and specific gravity. They had tangible weight. So he's getting to this. They were intangibles, but they were real. Okay? They carried shameful memories. They carried the common secret of cowardice, barely restrained, the instinct to run or freeze or hide. And in many respects, this was the heaviest burden of all, for it could never be put down. It required perfect balance and perfect posture. They carried their reputations. They carried the soldier's greatest fear, which was the fear of blushing. Men killed and died because they were embarrassed not to. It was what brought them to the war in the first place. Nothing positive, no dreams of glory or honor, just to avoid the blush of dishonor. They died so as not to die of embarrassment. And he says a little later, they were too frightened to be cowards. Too frightened to be cowards. So, all right. A lot of these stories have been published in the New Yorker and other places, and one of them is On the Rainy River. And it's a story about a guy John's age who gets drafted. He's just out of college. He's just graduated, and he gets a draft notice. And he's in northern Minnesota, way in northern Minnesota, and he knows he has to go. And
so this book is it a series of short stories?
It's a series of not really short stories, but short chapters about the central issue of the things they carried.
But it's different characters.
Well, no, the same characters reappear over and over.
So the name of the book, did you tell that before?
The things
They Carried by Tim O'Brien.
Okay.
But anyway, this is one of the more poignant stories. So this kid, he does not want to go. So he gets in a car, and he drives north, right near where the boundary waters are, right to Canada. And he stays, he just happens to find an old man who rents, like, fishing cabins, and he asks the old man if he could work for him. And the old man never says anything. He says, yeah, he can work for me. So he worked there for about a week, it's a great story, you should read it. He worked there for quite a long time. Nobody said anything about this young man of draft age who was right near the boundary waters. This never, ever came up. So in terms of truth, you know, real truth or storytelling truth, this issue never comes up. But finally, one day the old man takes him fishing on a boat, and they go up to right where the shore is for Canada. It's a long ride up through the boundary waters, and they go within, you know, easy swimming distance, right there. And the old man never says anything, so a lot of what happens on the way to Rainy River is what's not said. So anyway, he gets right near to where the boundary waters are, and nobody says anything, but the kid cries, and he cries, and he cries, and he cries. But he does not get out of the boat. So pretty soon, the old man turns around, he goes back. The next morning, he leaves quite a bit of money on the table, the man does. He says he has to leave for some errands. He says, you earn this money. And Tim O'Brien says, but I ate, you know, he says to the reader, but I ate, and I'm sure I took up plenty of that money. But anyway, he left the money on the table, and he went back, and he went to war. And he said, the day was cloudy. I passed through the towns with familiar names, through the pine forest and down to the prairie, and then to Vietnam, where I was a soldier, and then home again. I survived, but it's not a happy ending, he says. I was a coward. I went to war. He was afraid of disappointing his family, his friends, his mom and dad. He knew the war was wrong in his heart. He knew, he said, I wish they'd send the people who are voting. He resented them all, but he said, I was a coward. I went to war. So part of the truth is what you don't, it's just arresting, because we always think the war, people go to war, heroes, they're fighting for the country. But he says, I was a coward, I went to war. But anyway, I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about some of the truth here. All right, I read that. And that. And, ooh. Here, he talks about how to tell a war story. A true war story is never moral. It does not instruct, nor encourage virtue, nor suggest models of proper human behavior, nor restrain men from doing the things they've always done. If a story seems moral, do not believe it. If at the end of the war you feel uplifted, or you feel that some small bit of rectitude has been salvaged from the larger waste, then you have been made the victim of a very old and terrible lie. There is no rectitude whatsoever. There is no virtue. At a first rule of thumb, therefore, you can tell a true war story by its absolute and uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil. Listen to Rat Kiley. Coos, he says. He didn't want to say bitch. He certainly does not say woman or girl. He says coos. Then he spits and stares. He's 19 years old. It's too much for him. So he looks at you with those big, sad, gentle, killer eyes and says coos because his friend is dead and because it's so incredibly sad and true, and she never wrote back. You can tell a true war story if it embarrasses you. If you don't care for obscenity, you don't care for the truth. If you don't care for the truth, watch out how you vote. Send guys to war, they come home talking dirty. In many cases, a true war story cannot be believed. You can tell a true war story by the way it never seems to end. Not then, not ever. I'm just picking out. True war stories do not generalize. They do not indulge in abstractions or analysis. It comes down to gut instinct. A true war story, if told truly, makes your stomach believe. I'll read you a few more and I'll let you talk. Let's see. All right, I'll read you about the baby water buffalo. One of their men have just been killed, and Rat Kiley, he stepped back and he shot, there's this baby water buffalo. All right, a true war story makes your stomach believe. This one does for me. I've told it before many times, many variations, many versions, but this is actually what happened. We crossed the river and marched west into the mountains. On the third day, Kurt Lemon stepped on a booby trap 105 round. He was playing catch with Rat Kiley, laughing, and then he was dead. The trees were thick. It took nearly an hour to cut an IZ, an LZ for the dust off. In other words, an area where the helicopter could come down to pick up his body. Later, higher in the mountains, we came close to a baby Viet Cong water buffalo. What it was doing here, I don't know. No farms or paddies, but we chased it down and got a rope around it and led it to a deserted village where we set up for the night. After supper, Rat Kiley went over and he stroked its nose. He opened up a can of sea rations, pork and beans, but the baby buffalo wasn't interested. Rat shrugged. He stepped back and shot it through the right foot, right through the knee. The animal didn't make a sound. He went down hard and then got up again, and Rat took careful aim and shot off an ear. He shot it in the hindquarters and then in a little hump at its back. He shot it twice in the flanks. It wasn't to kill it, it was to hurt it. He put the rifle muzzle up against the mouth and shot the mouth away. Nobody said much. The whole platoon stood there watching, feeling all kinds of things. But there wasn't a great deal of pity for the baby water buffalo. Kurt Lemon was dead. Rat Kiley had lost his best friend in the world. Later in the week, he would write a long personal letter to the guy's sister who would not write back, but for now it was a question of pain. He shot off the tail. He shot away chunks of meat below the ribs. All around us, there was a smell of smoke and filth and deep greenery, and the evening was humid and very hot. Rat went to an automatic. He shot randomly, almost casually, quick little spurts in the belly and butt. Then he reloaded, squatted down, and shot it in the left front knee. Again, the animal fell hard and tried to get up, but this time it couldn't quite make it. It wobbled and it went down sideways. Rat shot it in the nose. He bent forward and whispered something, as if talking to a pet, and then he shot it in the throat. All the while, the baby buffalo was silent, or almost silent, just a light bubbling around where his nose had been. It lay very still. Nothing moved except the eyes, which were enormous, the pupils shiny, black, and dumb. Rat Kiley was crying. He tried to say something, but then cradled his rifle and went off by himself. The rest of us stood in a ragged circle around the baby buffalo. For a time, no one spoke. We had witnessed something essential, something brand new and profound, a piece of the world so startling there was not yet a name for it. Somebody kicked the baby buffalo. It was barely alive, though just barely, just in the eyes. Amazing, said Dave Jensen. My whole life I never saw anything like it. Never? Not hardly. Not once. Kyo and Michael Sanders picked up the baby buffalo. They hauled it across the open square, hoisted it up, and dumped it in the village well. Afterward, we sat waiting for Rat to get himself together. Amazing, Dave Jensen kept saying. A new wrinkle. I never seen it before. Michael Sanders took out his yo-yo. Well, that's Nam, he said. Garden of evil over here, man. Every sin's real fresh and original. How do you generalize? War is hell, but that's not the half of it, because war is also mystery and terror and adventure and courage and discovery and holiness and pity and despair and longing and love. War is nasty. War is fun. War is thrilling. War is drudgery. War makes you a man. War makes you dead. The truths are contradictory. So, the fact of the matter is this never happened. If you ask Tim O'Brien, that water buffalo incident never happened. But he says in here, this is true. This one did it for me. This is a true story. So, I'll read you one more about whether he killed. Daddy, did you ever kill a man? And it's time to be blunt, he says. This is just a page and a half, and then I'm going to quit and I'll let you talk. It's time to be blunt. I'm 43 years old, true, and I'm a writer now, and long ago I walked through Quang Nai province as a foot soldier. Almost everything else is invented. But it's not a game, it's a form. Right here, now, as I invent myself, I'm thinking of all I want to tell you about why this book is written as it is. For instance, I want to tell you this. 20 years ago, I watched a man die on a trail near the village of Mai Key. I did not kill him. But I was present, you see. Before, he says he did, and he describes everything that happened. And my presence was guilt enough. I remember his face, which was not a pretty face, because his jaw was in his throat, and I remember feeling the burden of responsibility and grief. I blame myself, and rightly so, because I was present. But listen, even that story is made up. I want you to feel what I felt. I want you to know why story truth is truer sometimes than happening truth. Here's the happening truth. I once was a soldier. There were many bodies and real faces, but I was young, and I was afraid to look. And now, 20 years later, I'm left with faceless responsibility and faceless grief. Here's the story truth. He was slim, dead, almost dainty, an almost dainty young man of about 20. He lay in the center of a red clay trail near the village of Mai Key. His jaw was in his throat. His one eye was shut and the other was a star-shaped hole. I killed him. What stories can do, I guess, is making things present. I can look at things I never looked at. I can attach faces to grief and love and pity and God. I can be brave. I can make myself feel again. Daddy, tell the truth, Kathleen can say. Did you ever kill anybody? And I can honestly say, of course not. Or I can honestly say yes. So this disturbed my students for a lot of reasons, but a number of them felt betrayed when he came to campus and he said, you never had a daughter named Kathleen. He has two children now. We figured it out because his oldest child was 2 years old. And Sandy, this is a guy who's just absolutely obsessed and driven. If you're by him, he wears a baseball cap and blue jeans even when he stands before a lecture hall, and he chain smokes cigarettes. I mean, by the time he's done with a lecture, he's got to have a cigarette. He's just like this.
Is he a Vietnam vet? Like,
yes, he is.
Oh,
yes, he is. Yes, he is. But I guess the question is, does it matter whether all this happened or not? What do you think?
I think that the fact that he was there in the war and he, like, when the character is saying that the acting truth, whatever, was that there were all those faceless bodies, dead and everything. And you can say that in a story, but that's something that people have heard before, and it doesn't mean as much. But if you can use your creativity to kind of describe in a more concrete way like that, like the shooting the water buffalo story, I think the fact that he could imagine that and that was how he described, like, his experience in Vietnam,
yeah,
that's enough to be a real living testament to what he went through.
Okay, so you kind of agree with this idea that sometimes storytelling truth is more than true than real truth.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I don't know. I graduated from high school in 62, and this all started in 64. I got married in 65. My husband was drafted. He was on the tarmac 7 times to go to Vietnam. He didn't go. He was in the infantry with the army. And I lost so many friends.
Yeah.
In that war. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Brings a lot of pain to me.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of people that came back from Vietnam. And my best friend died 10 years ago, and a lot of this happened.
It did?
It did. We don't know. I don't know everything that happened.
Yeah.
But a lot of it happened.
You could see why they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And he was over there for 2 tours, and another one of my best friends, he was there for 2 years, and he drove a boat up and down all those waterways. And they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And they talk about it within and amongst themselves. But it's like walking into a room of a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's dead silence because they won't share it.
Yeah.
And I've worked with the VA. And in the VA I have come across so many mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really sad.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the walking dead.
Yeah.
God, it was such an ugly one.
You're absolutely right. And there's hope, maybe, because you care so deeply. It would be so sad if nobody would cry over it.
Well, I lost my best friend because of
it. Yeah.
Something about honor. One of the stories talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that our whole notion of honor, as it gets wrapped up in war, needs to get examined.
Well, you want to talk about that?
Well, what's this honor that leads you to? I think Vietnam was especially terrible, but I also think that now we have all these World War II guys who are dying, and well, over the last 20 years actually, but. And there are stories from that war coming out, which was always the honorable war. And yet, as men die, they are telling their stories that are nearly as terrible as what happened in Vietnam.
If you really want to read
is always
a book about war, you should you got to read this book. But you should read, and this is not a fiction book. It's a book by Chris Hedges called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a good Holden book to read. This guy is a reporter for the New York Times. He won the Amnesty International Award for this book. But anyway, the argument that he makes in there, even as a reporter, there's something charismatic or heady that catches on. Even for a reporter, I'm going to get a good story. I'm going to go out there. And it's just kind of like a football team, right? We're going to go out, you know, we're going to, you know, that macho type of thing they do. So, but what Hedges argues is that it you get caught up in it, even as a reporter. And war is a force that gives us meaning. But, so anyway, I mean, that is really a good book that will tell you. And this is a man who's traveled all over Latin America, Bosnia, Croatia. He's reported all over. And of course, he's been in the Mideast too.
Well, that's what they're saying about the Iwo Jima thing. They're saying that this photographer that he had the people pose up there. But that was a second thing, because he did actually take the picture the first time, the real flag raising, and then the second time was for the statue to be made.
Yeah.
So that was...
Yeah, that's another good...
Now they're saying that he actually had that picture posed.
Yeah. But as far as telling a story, you know, I should leave you with this because we've got dish duty pretty quick. But as far as telling the story, I hope I've gotten you to think that, wait a minute, sometimes fiction can be more real than if we were to tell a story. I think the story about the water buffalo... Well, it tells us quite a bit about the nature of evil.
Yeah.
And even if it didn't happen, I think, as John said so beautifully, it certainly gives you a very realistic picture of the feelings and emotions and the kinds of things that, as you said too, could very well have happened there.
I know in my heart that it did.
Yeah.
I saw such a process.
Yeah.
That's the sad part.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
There were a lot of drugs that were...
You see why those guys got hooked on drugs?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it just makes perfect sense
to
me.
Well, in Southeast Asia, it was a huge field of poppy. I mean... Yeah.
But I mean, like, there's a passage in here where they buried Ted Lavender, and then they waited around for the helicopter to come up and get his body, and they all smoked his dope. I mean, you could see where...
What was the book about World War I?
I beg your pardon?
There was a book about...
Regeneration.
No, World War
The Good
I.
War?
Pardon?
The Good
World
War?
II. No. Anyway, but World War I hit such atrocities too, with the barbed wire and men getting caught.
And all war does. All war does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The trenches,
you know,
were a whole new thing.
And you know, the guys go, and a lot of feminists, and I'm not a big feminist, but I probably wouldn't be as privileged if it weren't for them. But they'll argue that, you know, the guys go, but almost inevitably it's the women and children who get shot. And just the stats that I just read to you from the New York Times, 58,000 of our men, 58,200 of our men died in Vietnam, but over a million of civilians died. And you can't tell me they were all men. You know, just think about it. Yeah.
Well, and they were children.
Women and children.
Sure.
And, you know, you remember the articles in the papers that we read about the soldiers shooting children, but they say, well, the kids had grenades. Well, some did, but, you know, they all get caught up in it. But it's...
But it's the families at home, too.
I can't begin to give you the answers, you know, but I hope I get everybody to think today about what happens when you go to war, what we're in for when we do this. And I hope voters think about it. Yeah.
Good luck.
Well, people like you start standing up, and Paul Olson has this idea of feet... and Facts for Peace. He's thinking about running across the country next year, and he's hoping that maybe it'll start a movement. It's a pipe dream. I don't know if I said, do it, man. Yes?
Just a reading suggestion. That Water Buffalo story reminded me of an essay by George Orwell called Shooting an Elephant.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a really powerful one to read.
That is an excellent suggestion, yeah, yeah.
Well, we have a businessman that stands at the end of our causeway and in a suit and has up signs about
peace. War's wrong.
War is wrong, and, well, and he invites people to join him.
I did see somebody join him.
Where is this?
Where we live. Where we live in Muskegon, over a river flat when it comes off Muskegon Lake, the road, you know, is a one way this way and one way this way. It's called a causeway. And there's this beautiful big fountain at the beginning on the south side, and he stands
it's
there.
It's a veterans memorial.
Yeah.
Are you from Seattle at all?
No.
There's a out by Madigan and Fort Lewis, they have, when we went to Iraq, a whole bunch of vets took an overpass for I-5, a major part of I-5, mm-hmm. and they stand out there all the time on the weekends, on the Veterans Day, and anything that comes along, and they have the whole, like the rail is all twisted with yellow, and so it's in vinyl, it's not gonna leave, and there's flags that fly through there, I mean, all the time, and you see the vets out there, and women and men both out there on this, and I can't remember what they're gonna rename it, but it's right before you get to Madigan and Fort Lewis. So, I mean, it's, and I drive that way often, and it's just, to me, it's just a gentle reminder of what it is and what it was. But I feel so proud of them.
Yeah.
And Vietnam was a war that people came back and they were spit on.
Yeah.
People that went to fight the war.
Well, they should have spit on it, you know, that they should spit on the voters. And the politicians, but anyway.
I agree with you.
Oh, it's all so sad. I hate to leave you sad, but maybe you'll think a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is that newspaper clipping still around somewhere? Oh, okay. I would stay and talk a little more, and I will later today. I'm resting my feet. But right now, we've got dishes to do.
I don't think I can handle it.
Well, maybe you ought to go out for a nice Holden hike or an ice cream cone.
Yeah, we went there.
I don't see it. You've been a really good group.
Thank you.
Thank you.